Underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Andre Dubuis III's first novel in a decade, Gone So Long, is a story filled with tension and empathy, set in a small working-class town on the coast of New Hampshire. The story is of a fractured family, a horrible crime and its tragic consequences, and the possibility of forgiveness and redemption. It is Dubuis territory, featuring familiar themes such as the desire and disappointment that fuel youth and force hard choices, the desperate need to escape a grim fate and begin anew, the raw beauty of love, and the power of late-life perspective-shifting encounters. Again, the title of the new novel is Gone So Long, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Andre Dubuis III. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Joe. It's a pleasure to be with you again.
It is always nice to have you on the program. So let me ask the obvious question, I think maybe the obvious question, of when I say first novel in a decade. So what brings you to that point of saying, did it take you 10 years to write this, or was it a point where you just said, okay, this is what I need to do right now?
Well, you know, the truth is, of all the writing that I find myself doing, the novel form is the one that draws me the deepest and most passionately. In the last 10 years, I also did write and publish a memoir and then also a collection of novellas. So I've been writing, you know, consistently all along. This one took about 5 years. I'm slow, you know. It takes me 3 to 5 years to give birth to a book. And so about, you know, yeah, I'd say 5 years after my most recent novel, The Garden Last Days, I began this story. And George Thorogood, the rocker, was asked once, man, why do you play garage rock and roll? He says, because that's what I like to listen to. And, you know, I like to read novels, and so that's what I try to write.
So here is a book set in a working class town on the coast of New Hampshire. And as I mentioned, is a story of a fractured family and a horrible crime and the consequences of that crime. Mm. What brought you to those ingredients in the beginning?
Well, it was a conversation I had with an inmate. I was doing research on a screenplay I was writing, and I was actually interviewing this man just to get information about another man with whom he'd done time. And after the lunch that I bought the inmate for research purposes, I just asked him in passing why he did time. And he said, oh, I killed my wife. And, you know, you and I have talked about my memoir, Townie. I have a particular hatred for male violence against women and kids. And I just, you know, took a breath and paid the bill. And I said, well, you got kids? And he said, oh, yeah, but they don't want to see me. And, Joe, I couldn't get that sentence out of my head. I couldn't. It echoed in my head for a few years. And I resisted it for a while. But one thing I've learned, if I've learned nothing over all these years of writing, it's, you know, I've learned to trust what I'm drawn to. I'm learned to trust what I'm curious about. And I couldn't stop wondering, my God, if you've done the worst thing possible to another human being, someone you vowed to love and care for, by the way, and you made a baby together, and that baby wants nothing to do with you for obvious reasons, what the hell is that like? And so I worked my way in, and to answer your question about, you know, the seaside town, I kept getting a blue-collar vibe off the guy, and I don't know why, but those are the kind of people I grew up with. Maybe that's part of it. And I just began to see this little crappy little beach strip that I grew up around, you know, in Massachusetts, and I began to write right there.
So in the novel, we meet Daniel Ahern, an ex-convict in his 60s, who 40 years ago committed this act of violence. I'm hoping you can read a little bit from the beginning of the book about Daniel.
Once again, her name moves through Daniel's blood like floating debris. It scrapes along his bones and pokes at his old organs, and it is a steady, pulsing nudge in his head. For days now, it has lodged itself in the searing ache in his hips and lower back, and he knows there's only one way to free it, but first he needs to finish these chairs he's caning under the sun. His eyes sting. His work glasses have slipped to the end of his nose. Daniel takes them off and lets them hang around his neck. He wipes the sweat off his forehead, then stands to stretch his back, but the pain remains, the sickness deep inside him now. He can feel it. It's not going anywhere. He sits on his stool and puts his glasses on and gets back to work. Today he notices his hands. They're his old man's, thick fingers, chipped and yellowed nails, though his father's always had carnival paint in his cuticles that never came out. Daniel reaches for the nail file he uses to weave the cane under and over itself. A warm wind kicks up from the east and brings with it beach sounds. Or maybe it's just Daniel's memory of them, the creaking gears of the Ferris wheel and the popping water balloons and the cries of gulls. There's the tinny whine of the carousel organ and the rattling jerk of the roller coaster cars, the shrieks of women and children hurled out over the hissing surf. But always there comes, rising up from inside him and getting louder, the blaring rock and roll of the Himalaya, Sugar Sugar, Proud Mary, Tommy Rowe singing He's So Dizzy His Head Is Spinning. Yesterday, after months of thinking about it, Daniel finally drove around the midway, and it isn't half what it used to be. The wooden roller coaster was torn down years ago, and the Ferris wheel they have now is kiddie-sized, the Himalaya gone, though there's a strip club with tall white columns at the doors. Half a block down from that, in the front window of a souvenir shop, a male mannequin in swimming trunks stands among beach towels and hula hoops under a two-month-old hand-lettered sign, Father's Day Sale, Half Price. Daniel hasn't seen his daughter in 40 years, and there is so much to tell her, but why would she listen? There was her mother's brown skin, her long wet hair that smelled like the ocean and baby oil and made him want to kiss every part of her. There was her small face and straight back, her breasts and brown nipples. All these years later, he can still see them, the tiny dark freckles around them, how white her breasts looked, the rest of her always so tanned because they were both amusement park kids who lived at the beach. Danny Ahern, Liam's son, the artist boy, though only a few called his father an artist. They called him Ahern or Old Liam or the Magic Mick because he could take sea air beaten shit and make it new again. The giant clown's head on the roof of the funhouse, all the signage for joints up and down the midway, the 5 o'clock club, Willie's hard and soft ice cream, the pavilion and bathhouse in Shaheen's Funorama Park. Linda's father owned the Penny Arcade. Her family lived there too, though you wouldn't know it. Past the skee ball and slot machines, the pinballs and billiard tables, was a black wall, and on the other side of that wall was the apartment Linda lived in with her mother and little brother Paul and her father, Jerry Doobie, who hated Danny because he could smell how much he wanted his Linda. Everybody wanted her, and that was the problem.
Andre Debuse III, reading from his new novel, Gone So Long, published by Norton. Man, I love your sentences.
Thank you, brother. That's encouraging.
So give us a sense of what it takes to for you, when you say 5 years, is that what you labor over?
Yeah, well, yeah, I labor over the sentences, I sure do, but I always try and I seek for the sentences to penetrate the dream world of the imagination and to really get into character and scene. And but I do want the sentences to sing, but they can't. I guess what I'm trying to say is I think that style is subordinate to story, and I hope they're always in service of story. But I do work on them.
So Daniel wants to see his daughter, and it's his last wish before he dies. So then we meet Susan Dunn, and tell us a little bit about her and what she is grappling with in just expecting this encounter.
When we meet Susan, she's been living for years down in Florida, where she was actually raised by her maternal grandmother. And she's 43 years old. She's been married for 3 years to Bobby, who's a musicologist. And he loves the work of Ornette Coleman, the jazz man. And she's been an aspiring writer her whole life. She's got nothing but a string of failures behind her in that way. Not so much publishing failures. She hasn't published, just she hasn't been able to finish anything. She's an adjunct professor, you know, one of the migrant farm workers of academia. And she's not sure. She loves the man she married. She's been stricken with anxiety and depression most of her life. She's traveled a lot, had a lot of boyfriends and, you know, loveless encounters. That's the Susan we meet as the novel opens, and she's just beginning to write an accidental memoir. She hates memoirs, she wants nothing to do with one. She actually calls them memoirs, but she's starting to write directly about her own childhood, and part of that experience is that she witnessed the murder of her mother when she was 3 years old.
I have talked to other writers about this, and it's an interesting phenomenon, I think, when writers write about writing and what that is like for you.
Yeah, I resisted it, actually. I was talking about this last night with a friend. When I first began, I wanted Susan to be an actor, and because I'd done some acting in my life and I hadn't really written about it. But, you know, this... And you and I have talked about this before, Joe. It's so strange how the characters will take over. She made it very clear she's not an actor or actress. She's a writer, and I didn't want to write about writing. And then I find myself really enjoying it. You know, it was because I was writing from my wheelhouse, because I've been writing all my adult life, man, so I have a few things to say about it. And Susan doesn't necessarily share my opinions about it, but... I found it kind of enjoyable to have the writing within the writing, and from the point of view of a woman who wanted nothing to do with the kind of writing she was doing. So, which I think is a real constant. You know, the writer, beautiful novelist Meg Wolitzer, and I had a conversation just recently where she said the most brilliant, characteristically brilliant thing. We were talking about how an idea will come to you, or a character will come to you, or a situation, and you'll start to resist it. And I did resist this one, just for obvious reasons. I didn't want to step into this darkness. And I also didn't want to humanize a man who'd killed his wife, but that's another story. And what Meg Wolitzer said, she said, but that resistance is almost like a marinade for the entire process. And I think that is so helpful. And so even Susan's resistance to the writing of her own story helped her marinate in the ultimate project, but also helped me discover a lot about her that felt true.
In writing about Susan, what's fascinating about this character is she obviously suffers from the trauma of that night, but she doesn't remember that night.
No. Yeah, weird, huh? She was three. She saw it. She buried that. She, for years, her grandmother who raised her said that both her parents died in a car accident. I believe Susan was 18 or 19. She was a college kid. Lois told her the truth. Lois is her maternal grandmother. Told her the truth. And but it's still, the memory really just came back in shards, which has been my own experience with memory. You know, it's fragmented, it's flawed, it's unreliable, it's reliable, it's real, it's not. It gives the writer a lot to work with, the nature of memory.
It also, and I mentioned the word earlier, but you really do write a lot about empathy here on both sides of this equation.
Well, I try to write with empathy. There's a wonderful line from Ernest Hemingway to a letter to his editor, Maxwell Perkins at Scribner's. He said, you know, Max, the job of the writer is not to judge, but to seek to understand. And I subscribe to that thinking. I unless you're writing satire or, you know, something that's purposely judgmental, what I'm most turned on about creatively is really trying to step into the private skin of another human being I will never be, living a life I probably will never have, And that's where the creative thrill is. And frankly, you know, that's what I seek as a reader as well. I tend to prefer that kind of work where I can feel the writer, you know, and I'm not going to name names, but there are some famous writers and famous books out there that I kind of detest, where it's self-referential.
Yeah.
I'm not naming anybody, but it's self-referential. It's hip. I mean, you can really just feel the writer poking fun at his characters. And I'm sorry, it's usually a him. At his characters to show how smart and world-weary and ironic and wise he is. I can't stand that kind of writing. So for me, when you talk about empathy, my characters aren't necessarily empathetic, but I sure as hell am trying to put myself in that state to find out who they are.
Which gets us to this idea of the relationship between these two and what ultimately will come of it. What are the limits of recovery? What are the limits of absolution? And are those things even possible?
Yeah, you're nailing it, man. I mean, those are the questions that fueled the entire trip for me. You know, I never know what's going to happen without giving away too much of the book. You know, Daniel finds where she's living, and it's in Florida, and he sets out to drive down the coast to just see her one time before he dies. The last time he saw her, she was 3 years old, ripped from his arms by the police, and he never saw her again. And now he's 63. All those questions that you just put so well were in my mind, and I try not to ever think ahead or outline or plot a story. I try to find it one step at a time. And so I never knew what would happen with those questions. I think ultimately, though, oh, man, the whole story seems to reflect a lot of my own vision, which is forgiveness is probably the best thing any of us can do for our own souls. And, man, is it hard to do.
It certainly is, but it's something that often fuels the doubt, right? Even if we want to hate, even if we want to despise, the thing that's holding us back is that idea of, well, or I could forgive.
Yes, and it's simple, but it's not easy. And I think ultimately, in order maybe to achieve that state, that full state of forgiveness, you must surrender yourselves totally to the reality of the other. Not to excuse the action, but to maybe see those hidden panels of memory that have led to his or her actions. And, I mean, to me, that takes maybe that's what I'm getting at here, is that in this novel, Gone So Long, is that maybe the act of forgiveness can only happen once we totally surrender ourselves to an act of empathy, where we walk in the shoes of the other for a good long while imaginatively. But man, when you're wounded, and especially if you're wounded deeply at the hands of the one in whose shoes you're trying to walk, good luck.
So one of the things that comes from the novel is Susan, who is an aspiring writer and as you say, is an adjunct English professor. So one of the questions is, how does this impact her and how does this form her, and does it change her as a writer, which of course then becomes the obvious question that I would ask you. Do those experiences fundamentally change you, or do they just inform and are one part of a much larger self?
I think B. Part of me rails, just philosophically rails, against some of the simple bromides of psychology, you know, that if you've experienced this trauma as a child, you're this way as an adult. If your father was an alcoholic, then you're this way psychologically. If you've survived this kind of, you know, trauma. And while I know there's great wisdom and truth to all of that, part of me just resists the notion that we're that simple, that you just check off a menu list of psychic qualities that you adapt as a result of what happened to you as a kid or a young person. So to get to your larger question, though, I do think that more than anything, these traumas, these wounds, these blessings, these beautiful experiences, that they make us the walking bucket of mystery that we all are. You know, I mean, one of my favorite discussions on this is from an essay by the great American writer Tim O'Brien, The Things That Carry Tim O'Brien.
Right.
In an essay called The Magic Show, in which he says one of the most brilliant things I've ever seen about literary characterization. He said, look, successful characterization is not a nailing down or a pinning down process where you nail the character. I got it. That's the kind of guy he is. But quite the opposite, O'Brien argues. The deeper you go, the more mysterious we get. You know, I've known my mother for 59 years. Who the hell is that lady? Mm-hmm. I've been sleeping with the same woman for 30 years. We've had three kids. She's my life partner and soulmate, my wife, Fontaine. Who is she? You know, who are we? I mean, I think Americans get impatient with that because we like to have it all laid out clearly on a gleaming staircase to success and happiness, but I think it's all a bit of a lie.
I agree with everything you just said, but the one thing I wonder about is, given your profession as a writer, having written a memoir that was so detailed as yours was, and looking at this character of Susan, who is writing as well, it seems that a writer is also investigating, and there is a cathartic aspect to what they are doing, that they are exploring perhaps much more than the average human would be doing.
I totally agree. But, you know, there's that line from her husband, Bobby, the musicologist. I forget exactly what it is, but he says something like, you know, life is chaos, and to shape it too much is a lie. And, you know, he particularly loves the work of Ornette Coleman, who's a really chaotic jazz man who thought that harmony, melody, and rhythm all shared the same value. A lot of jazz men and women hate Coleman's music. I find it interesting, but Bobby does. My point is, I bring in Bobby Dunn, that character, Susan's husband, because he was kind of voicing for me my other view. I have two opposing views inside me on this. So one is that, and also what you said is, I hold that. What the hell is the point of writing at all if you're not trying to capture and alleviate some of the chaos? You know, Faulkner, I'm paraphrasing here, but he said it beautifully. He said, look, the job of the writer is to freeze time so that in 100 years, when the reader reads it, it moves again. And so if you look at the word fiction, it actually comes from the Latin fictus, and it means to fashion or to shape. And I was aware when I was writing my memoir, Townie, I was very careful not to put in anything that didn't happen. The James Fry scandal had just happened. Right. I was particularly sensitive. Oh, my God, what were you drinking? Heffenreffer? Was that a SS Chevelle I put in the lake or a Trans Am? And, I mean, I did some crazy neurotic fact-checking. But still, what I was doing was fashioning and shaping events of my life into a narrative. You know, I didn't drag the reader through every girlfriend I ever had. I didn't drag the reader through every ham sandwich I ever had. I'm agreeing with you. The whole job of the writer is to freeze time, is to fashion and shape, is to slow the clock and step into that dream world. One of my favorite lines is from Lao Tzu, the founder of Taoism. Mm-hmm. Soften the light, become one with the dusty world.
So with that said, and through the process of writing this novel over 5 years, and if indeed the light has been softened, does it create a different starting place for whatever the next project will be?
That's a great question, Joe. I've never been asked that. You know, I think I'm going to have an insight right here.
We welcome those, Andre.
I think I'm just going to spill it. I think with each story the writer writes, certainly for me, you know, for me, I've always looked at writing as an act of excavation. Again, well, how do you do that? Well, it seems to me the primary fuel should be curiosity, and you said it yourself, an act of investigation. And so you dig and you dig and you dig, and then something magical happens. You hit this underwater current that starts to pull you, and that's when the story starts to write itself. And it's a wonderfully pleasurable state to be in, even if it's dark material. By digging and digging and digging, especially when you're digging into material that you resisted, as I did in the beginning of this novel, Gone So Long, I think it brings you down to a deeper place in the earth, or your own imaginative earth, and maybe you're starting from a deeper place than before.
Andre Dubuis's new novel is Gone So Long. It is published by Norton. Andre, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. I'll tell you, you handed me a copy of this book in May, and I have been dying to talk about it for months. So I'm glad we're finally there to be able to chat about it now that it's out. The title again, Gone So Long, Andre Dubuque III. Thank you so much for being with us. It's always a great pleasure.
Joe, thank you, and thank you for having your show, and thanks for having me on it again. I wish you well.
Thank you. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us about past book shows at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past programs via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.